Well, spring is underway once again, and that means it's time for another edition of What's Bugging You, Red River Radio's program about our insect world with Dr. Beverly Burden, an associate professor of biology at LSUS and our resident entomologist. I'm Bill Beckett, the program director for Red River Radio, and we invite you to call in tonight with your questions about our insect world, both fiendish and friendly, at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. Dr. Burden, glad to have you with us again.
I'm very glad to be here, Bill. Thank you.
So we're back in the baseball season, which means that we're back to the emerald ash borer. Of course, many of the finest baseball bats made with ash wood. What can you tell us about the latest developments with this insect and its infiltration into the nation?
The latest news that will impact our listening area is that the emerald ash borer has now been found in Webster Parish, just east of Bossier Parish, which means it's coming into the Arklatex area. And whereas it primarily only destroys ash trees, it will find them. And what I talked to the Louisiana Agricultural Extension Forest Agent, Ricky Kilpatrick, about this, and what we would like to do is start to mapping out a lot of the urban ash trees that are in Shreveport-Bossier, and perhaps maybe starting programs in other areas so we can start monitoring these ash trees and then try to protect them from the emerald ash borer. One of the first things you'll notice if you have an ash tree and it may be infested with the emerald ash borer, you'll see a thinning at the top where the leaves aren't getting the proper nutrition and water that's being brought up from the roots, because that's what the emerald ash borer does. It goes in between the bark and the hardwood part of the tree, and it basically eats out all of the areas that what we call the vasculation, where the nutrients go up the tree into the leaves, and it's basically cutting off the food and water supply.
So basically it's going in and tapping that food and water supply and using it itself, or is it just the destruction of
it's eating the tissue, not okay. So much the nutrients in the water, but it's eating that nice vascularized tissue and damaging and then they're called borers because they'll bore little channels and little it's actually rather pretty. Sometimes other insects that do this, they're called engravers because it actually looks like somebody went in and engraved the wood. And they're also using those tunnels as nurseries. They'll lay their eggs in there. And if you look at your ash tree and you see exit holes in the shape of the letter D upside down, then that's a clear indication. And these guys are small. They're only about a fourth to an eighth of an inch wide and not very long. But they are beautiful. They're metallic green, and we're going to need to monitor their forward progression westward.
So if there's listeners out there with ash trees in their yard and they're concerned, who can they call in our area to help them discover whether or not they have an infestation?
I would bring samples of the bark into an extension office, and the extension office should be able to tell you whether it's a flat-headed borer or a round borer. You might also monitor for the adults in that area. And another clear sign that you may have a problem, not just with the emerald ash borer, but other borers and in other trees, is a heavy population of woodpeckers, because a woodpecker is a natural predator for these. And so closely monitoring, inspecting, and then if you feel like an insecticide application is possible, then you need to call an arborist.
Okay, so you would need a professional to come out and get the correct insecticide to repel these insects.
At this time.
Okay. You are listening to What's Bugging You with Dr. Beverly Burden, our resident entomologist. She's also an associate professor of biology here at LSUS. And you can call in with your questions at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. 8502. Anything about our insect world, either the fiendish kind or the friendly kind, is welcome. And it is gardening season right now, which means that folks are putting a lot of newborn plants out. Tomatoes have probably been underway for a couple of 3-4 weeks here. And, you know, this is a time when insects are also springing forward, so to speak. What do gardeners need to pay attention to so that they have a good, healthy garden?
One of the key things is buying plants that may be resistant, and there's something that's called Louisiana super plants, and they can get a list of those from their Agricultural Extension Agency. For example, just for people in Louisiana, and this is a website, so anybody can access it. It's lsuagcenter.com, and in those areas, they can find out the list of the Louisiana super plants that are oftentimes built-in resistant to fungus pathogens, bacterial pathogens, and insect feeding. Whether you have resistant varieties or not, inspections of the plants, make sure that they're good and healthy. No mottling on the leaves. You want to make sure that they're disease-free, because if you have a diseased plant, then they're more likely to be more susceptible to insect attack.
Right, yeah.
You know, if you hit them, it's like a 1-2 punch. And so once you get them in your yard, make sure that the foliage is healthy. A lot of people just look on top, but most of the insects feed from the underside of the leaf. And so they'll need to, you know, look, get down, kind of lift the leaves up, take a look on the outside, and if there's any noticeable wilting of the plant, that's indicative of aphids. That's going to be, especially on the younger, tender plants early in the season. If you start seeing chewing marks, then you may not see them during the day. They may come out and feed at night like June bugs do. You know, any caterpillars, what people would call worms, they're going to be feeding on the underneath of the bark. And that's when you either need to do some kind of a mechanical control by knocking them off, spraying them off, using insecticidal soaps. And then if you want to go to something heavier, you can get into the insecticidal aisle.
You are listening to What's Bugging You with our resident entomologist, Dr. Beverly Burden. She's here to take your questions tonight about our insect world, both the fiendish insects and the friendly insects. You can give us a call at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. We have our first caller online, Clyde from Nacogdoches. Clyde, what's your question tonight?
Well, I've got a question, I guess, of an identification issue. About a week ago, it seems like we were just absolutely overrun with some sort of a caterpillar, probably 2 inches long, a little bit fuzzy, spine, you know, hairs bristling out on it, greenish, yellowish-green with a dark stripe down the side. I mean, they were crawling all over everything. Any idea what they might be?
Well, you actually hit on one of my favorite topics, Klein, and that is the identification of caterpillars. Caterpillars will basically come in two different forms, those that are very smooth and shiny, and then the ones that are spiny, like he just described. If they're spiny, a lot of times these little spines are intended to break off and maybe release a little toxin or just become irritating. So I want to warn the listening audience not to handle these if they can keep from it. Now, what you probably described was something like a tent caterpillar, and this is the time of year that they're going to be coming out. They hatch at the bark of the tree. They climb up to the tree. Sometimes with the winds and the rains that we've been having, they might have been falling, you know, being blown off. And things like the pecan caterpillar would be a classic one that would fall into that category. There are many, many caterpillars that have stripes on them. Some of them are the army worms. One thing I didn't have a chance to ask Klein is if they were on the ground or if they were on the vegetation. And so do you have the answer to that, Klein?
Well, actually, mainly some on seemed like they were crawling across our walkway and up and making their way along a handrail of a ramp down off of our screened-in porch.
That's classic signs of the army caterpillar or caterpillars that are in that group. And that's something else that our listening audience may not understand, is that caterpillars turn into moths. Some of them do turn into butterflies, but most of the ones that we'll see on a casual basis will be turning into moths. And then these moths will hatch and they'll lay their eggs, and then the caterpillars will eat the foliage of the eggs. But there are oftentimes, when they hatch out at this time of the year, they will migrate, trying to find their host plant or any kind of plant to eat. They're a nuisance, but they're not going to attack you in the night. So I would just get a broom or my blower and just get them out of my way. And then if you see them starting feeding on your plants, well, then that's a different matter altogether. But thank you for the question.
Well, you're welcome.
All right. And you are listening to What's Bugging You with our resident entomologist, Dr. Beverly Burden. You can give us a call tonight at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. Any questions about our insect world are welcome, and Dr. Beverly Burden is here tonight to answer your questions. One of the things that comes up every spring and summer is fire ants. I notice a mound right outside of our building out there by the edge of the road. This is the time of season when they start their active nest building and coming back to active life. Can you tell us what can be done right now at this stage that would best mitigate the problems of fire ants?
First, let me explain a little bit about the reproductive behavior of fire ants, because that's one thing that's impacting the ecosystem at this time. When the temperatures rise to the 70s to the 80s, and we have these showers that come through, fire ants are programmed to go on their mating swarms right after a rain when the temperature reaches a certain warm level. And the queens will leave their mounds, fly off into the air. The males that are going to mate with the queens are also weaned. They will fly off. The queen will mate with the males, and then the queen will find a suitable place to set up a colony. When she gets back down to the ground, her wings fall off, and it may take 2 or 3 weeks for her to actually establish a colony big enough to be seen. When you look out at a pasture or your backyard and you see 1 or 2 fire ant mounds, one thing that you're not seeing is that there's many other fire ant colonies out there. They're just very small at this time, and they're actually being suppressed by the larger mounds, the larger colonies. And so what I tell people to do is use a two-step program. The first step is to broadcast baits. These are normally going to be some type of pyrethrin, and they're not used in a very large amount, just a few granules. It'll tell you you'll probably need to get a little hand spreader, or you can just do it by hand and cast out baits. That will kill many of these smaller mounds because they'll take the bait back to their smaller colonies. And then when you do see larger mounds pop up, then use something that we call a surface treatment. And normally that's going to be, I recommend anything with the active ingredient of acephate in it. Sprinkle a few bit of acephate. It smells terrible, but it works the best. And sprinkle a little, like a teaspoon on the mound of acephate, and wait 2 or 3 days, and the mound will be gone. So broadcast baits. If something does pop up, surface treatment.
You are listening to What's Bugging You with Dr. Beverly Burden, our resident entomologist, and your questions about our insect world are welcome right now at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. Rachel from Minden, you're online. What's bugging you tonight?
Yes, I was wanting to ask her a question. About a week and a half to 2 weeks ago, we got up one morning. We have about 4 oak trees in the front yard. And looking out on the lawn, it looked like it had rained leaves out from underneath the trees. They were just scattered leaves underneath them. We went out and checked the trees. You couldn't find any insects or any bugs on them. They had all come off at the end of the stem, so the leaves on the ground didn't have any stem on them at all. They were just like cut or just detached from the stem. On closer inspection, we found just a couple of leaves that kind of looked like maybe on the tree that had been sort of rolled up, but nothing really inside of them. And we were trying to figure out what in the world had caused that. We're thinking of having the tree sprayed for insects, but there really wasn't a sign of insects on them. It did it maybe 2 or 3 mornings in a row, and then it sort of stopped.
There may be several things going on here. First, with respect to the smaller limbs being blown down and the terminal leaves not being on there, that may be indicative of possibly some type of a pathogen. I'm guessing it would probably be more bacterial than viral. Plants get sick too. Now, with the rolled leaves, there are 2 groups of insects that will take in rolled leaves. One are bees, and the chances of them having any interaction with an oak tree is very small. The second one are some forms of caterpillars. They will roll the leaves as actually a little tent to live in, not to be confused with the tent caterpillars that looks like there's a giant spider web in the tree. Those are completely different. I would monitor the tree for the next 4 to 5 weeks, see if there's any thinning in the canopy, see if you do see any kind of insect damage. But this just might be typical, spring wind damage that just caught the tree off guard. Not that the tree braces themselves, but them just kind of anthropomorphizing that.
Yeah, and it was very odd because all the leaves didn't have any stems on them. They were just like detached from the stems. They were still on the tree. Just the leaves were scattered around.
And leaf morphology, there is actually tissue that is in the stem of the leaf that's called an abscission zone that is actually designated to, in the fall, that's where the tree may break off. And there are certain tree chemicals that control the breaking off of that leaf. And so I would monitor the tree for the next 4 weeks. If it seems to bounce back, which I think it probably will, if not, then you might want to call somebody else out to take a look at it. Good luck with that, Rachel, and thank you for calling.
All right, thank you. Bye-bye.
You are listening to What's Bugging You with our resident entomologist, Dr. Beverly Burden. She's on hold tonight with us to answer your questions about our insect world, both fiendish and friendly, at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. We have a number of lines open, but we have Ben from Dry Prong next. Ben, you're online. What's bugging you?
Hello, Ms. Burden.
Hello. What's your question tonight, Ben?
Hello?
Yes, hello. Can you hear me now?
Okay, great. Ms. Burton, I wanted to know if I could ask you a couple of questions. First, about the emerald ash borer. Does it hit greens, white, pumpkin? Does it hit all the different kinds of ashes right here, or does it prefer a specific one? I like to work in my shop at night when it gets hot, and I like to try to direct or encourage the insects to go out to my chicken yard, which is about 50 yards away.
Mm-hmm.
Can I change my lights around, color my lights around, to get them to go out that way? And last year I had a real bad problem with millipedes.
Hmm.
I had an inch long black with a white skirt on. I had mats of them up in the corners of my rafters in my shop at times.
Hmm.
And is there anything I can lay down to discourage them? I don't want to sterilize the place, but I'd like to not have so many of them this year.
Yeah. Let's go back to the emerald ash borer first, Ben. There are many different varieties of ash trees, and I'm not a forest entomologist, but just like there's many different varieties of oak trees, but if it's going to attack one ash, I would expect that it would attack all ashes. And as you know, if you do have an ash tree, it has that very characteristic alternate or parallel branching of the leaves. No other tree really looks like that. As far as the lights and the chicken coop, most insects are going to be attracted to white light, but the most attractive light is UV light. And if you want to put some UV lights, they're going to be much more attracted to that out to your chicken pen. And great for you that you're encouraging your chickens to eat, you know, the natural things out there and to form some type of a biological control agent for you. That's what we call it in entomology. Millipedes are normally need two things to be effective. One is dampness and one is darkness. And so if they're coming up from the rafters of your shop, I'd be very concerned that I may have a roof problem up there. So go up, inspect your roof, and make sure that you're not having any leaks. It would be, and millipedes normally stay on the ground. So I'm kind of wondering, I'm not questioning whether they're millipedes or not, but they are a nuisance. But unlike centipedes who have fangs and venom, millipedes, the only damage or the only noxious thing about millipedes, I could say, is if you pick them up, they can exude a very smelly toxin that's very hard to wash off your skin. And it actually is noxious to birds. It causes them to be nauseated, so birds don't like to eat millipedes very well. So don't send the millipedes out to your chicken coop. I wouldn't recommend that. And I hope that answered some of your questions, Ben, and thank you for calling.
Thank you, ma'am.
All right. You are listening to What's Bugging You with our resident entomologist, Dr. Beverly Burden. And she'll take your calls tonight at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. 855-252-8502. Pete, you're on deck. We're coming to you in just a moment. I do have one question. You mentioned centipedes in this area. Are there the variety of poisonous centipedes that I know when I was in Florida, there were a number of them that were quite toxic?
Well, we'd like to choose the word venomous rather than poisonous.
Okay.
And they are not lethal. They're not fatal. They're probably equivalent to the sting of a scorpion or a larger wasp sting. And centipedes are very fast, and they're very flat. Millipedes are very slow. They're very round. And so, and millipedes are great to have around. They take care of a lot of the underground grub pests that might be feeding on the roots of your plants. So I encourage millipedes to... centipedes to habitat my area.
All right. So there again, they can be beneficial, although
absolutely.
Can be a nuisance, but not necessarily dangerous.
Beneficial, just leave them alone.
Right. Okay. That's a good thing. You're listening to What's Bugging You with Beverly Burden, our resident entomologist. You can call in at 800-552-8502. Pete from Texas, you're online next. What's bugging you tonight?
I want to know about what I call bumblebees.
Mm-hmm.
They seem amazing little, I guess they're insects. I've never gotten close to one because they avoid you. They seem amazing little creatures.
We love bumblebees. I don't know anybody who doesn't like bumblebees other than those people that messed with the bumblebees and might have gotten stung. Bumblebees are not the same as honeybees, but they are pollinators. Honeybees live in a hive. Bumblebees live in nest in the ground. Now, this time of the year, you're going to see two large bees flying about your backyard, or what I like to call your ecosystem. And bumblebees, if you look at the back half of a bumblebee, you're going to see yellow and black markings. If it looks like a bumblebee, but the back half of the bee is entirely black, then that's going to be a carpenter bee. Bumblebees are very beneficial. Carpenter bees, arguably not so much beneficial, because carpenter bees will take their mouth parts and drill just like a drill bit into wood, and especially like rafters and eaves or decking area, and then they will lay eggs in that wood and basically make a nursery for it. Normally, it's not so much to have structural damage, but it certainly is aesthetically unpleasing. And then now you have all these little bees hatching. And so I would discourage the carpenter bees, which has a black behind, and certainly promote and encourage the bumblebees that have a yellow and black behind.
Just by blocking off the hole?
You know, you can do that. Actually, I use two things when I seek. When I first moved into my house, I had carpenter bees attacking some of the areas on my back decking, and I would take a dowel stick about the same size as the hole, and you know, dowel sticks are made of that like really soft wood, and you just snap it off. I also have a badminton racket that I keep on my back porch, and it's exactly perfect for just knocking them to the ground and then, you know, mechanical, this is what I call mechanical control rather than chemical control, knocking them down with my little badminton racket, and then, you know, use the old foot and stomp method and take care of them that way, and that way they may not drill actually into the wood. You can prevent that. Preventive measures. Is that it, Pete?
Yes, ma'am. I just think they're fascinating, like dragonflies. Anything that can fly up and down, backwards and forwards, is pretty fascinating to me.
And they are insects. They're in the whole grouping of wasps, bees, and ants called the Hymenoptera.
Thank you, ma'am.
Thank you, Ben.
You are listening to What's Bugging You with our resident entomologist, Dr. Beverly Burden. We're taking your calls tonight at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. And quickly, what's the difference between a bumblebee and a yellow jacket? And is a yellow jacket a part of the same family?
Well, that's a great question. Bumblebees are bees. If you look at the broad categories of wasp and bees, there are several distinctions. The wasp tend to have a... where you cannot see it, they're behind and their thorax. You know, all insects have a head, thorax, and abdomen. The connection between the thorax and the abdomen appear to be very broad in bees, most of bees, not all bees, but most bees. Whereas in wasp, the attachment of the abdomen to the thorax tends to be a little bit more narrower. And so yellow jackets are wasp. There are other distinctions that we use, but you normally need a microscope to see them. And yellow jackets are in a very large family of wasps that we call vespides, the vespids. Your yellow jackets are in there. The mahogany wasp are in there. The paper wasp are in there as well.
You're listening to What's Bugging You with Dr. Beverly Burden. You can give us a call at 800-552-8502 with any questions about our insect world. And Joy from Grayson, Louisiana, you're online next. What's bugging you tonight? Hello, Joy. We can hear her listening to the radio.
Yeah, I can hear it in the background. I think we might have lost Joy.
All right, we're going to go to our next caller, and I'm not sure who this is. I don't have the name up yet, but you're online with Dr. Whoa. Well, we're having a problem here. Let's try our next caller. You're online with Dr. Beverly Burden. What's your question tonight? Hello?
Is that me?
Yes, that's you.
Oh, hi. My name's Heidi. I'm from Shreveport. I had a question about fleas in the yards and things, and I don't like spraying for them. And I was wondering if there was like a type of bug or a good bug or a good bird or whatever that would eat fleas.
Fleas in the yard are a problem. One thing about fleas is that the adult fleas basically take blood meals, while the immature fleas are more like beetle grubs, where they're feeding on decayed material. As far as I know, there is no naturally occurring flea chemical that you can spray in your yard. But let me explain to you what I would do. There is something that's called an insect growth regulator. And it's not the same thing as an actual insecticide, but it is something that you will be spraying in your yard. The active ingredient for it should be something that's called a methoprene, M-E-T-H-O-P-R-E-N-E, and that's called an insect growth regulator, and it will prevent the baby fleas from growing up to become the adult fleas, and it's the adult fleas that feed on blood. Now, you can also use an adult side for the fleas, and it's not a bad insecticide either. It's a natural insecticide. It's actually a chemically derived from chrysanthemum flowers called permethrin. Anything that ends in the suffix T-H-R-I-N is in the pyrethroid family of insecticides, and it's completely safe for children and pets. And so is the methoprene, because it's targeted only for insects. You may feel like you're spraying an insecticide, but you're spraying a naturally occurring insecticide that goes in and messes up with their natural biology. And that's what I would do in your yard. Are there any other questions, Heidi?
No, that'd be it. Let me ask, is there a predator of insects? Does anything eat fleas?
Well, let me think about that for a second. There's always something that eats something. But for fleas, I think it would be more of a parasite than a predator. And I would think that there might be some nematodes, little bitty roundworms, that may parasitize on fleas, but I'd have to do a little bit of work on that. But I think it would be more parasitic control than predator control.
Great. Well, I appreciate your answer very much. Thank you about the chrysanthemum thing. That's wonderful.
Okay. Good luck, Heidi.
You're listening to What's Bugging You from Red River Radio with our resident entomologist, Dr. Beverly Burden. And she is here to answer your questions tonight. And we're going to go next to Joy. We lost you a little bit a while ago. Joy from Grayson, you're online with Dr. Beverly Burden. What's your question tonight?
I have two questions. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Oh, good. One is about ants. I heard the caller, the answer you gave to the caller with the red ants. Does that advice apply to regular ants, too?
No, ma'am, it does not.
Okay. Well, my problem was with regular ants. I live on a tree farm. I'm surrounded by pine trees, and I have a little clearing about a quarter of an acre. And right now I've got about 9 or 10 ant nests. I get rid of them, and then they come back repeatedly. Is there any way I can discourage them, or what should I do to get rid of them?
Are they nesting in the ground, or they come in the house? Are they?
Well, at times they've come in the house. Right at the moment, I don't have a problem with them coming in the house, but they're unsightly and they're in the way. You know, where I would step on them when I'm going to my garden or whatever.
You might go ahead and try the what we call the top treatment of the ants mounds, and go ahead and try the acephate. It's a good general.
Acephate.
Acephate. And I would try that. One thing that I wouldn't try is trying to burn them out. That's not a good idea, especially in a pine forest.
Uh-huh. And no, I wouldn't do that.
There's some people that will pour boiling water, and that might be okay unless you're trying to also encourage grass to grow in the understory of the pine trees. But try those two methods, and good luck with that. And if not, call us back.
Oh, okay. My other question is, I have a rose bush, and last year, like late summer or early fall, something attacked it and ate all the leaves down to the stem. And I know it was an insect because I put a basket over it, and nothing could get through except insects. And the last few leaves still got eaten. And I also saw a wild bush, a wild shrub, I don't know what kind, that had the same kind of damage. What could it be, and what could I do to prevent it or attack it?
Right. There is a beetle. It almost looks exactly like a June bug, but it's greenish tint. It's called the rose chafer, C-H-A-F-E-R, and they feed on the leaves of rose bushes at night. And so one of the things that you might want to do is go out there at night and inspect the tree and see if you see any of these large June bug-type insects feeding on it. And there are a very nice thing that you can do. It's called the milky spore disease, and you can get these bacterial spores that's completely harmless to you. But you can sprinkle them on the leaves, and then the rose chafer will eat these bacteria. Actually, they're fungal spores. Let me change bacteria to fungal spores. And they'll eat these fungus spores, and they'll get this fungus infection. And basically, the fungus will just eat the beetle from the inside out. It may not be a very nice thing to do with the beetles, but it would save your rose bush.
Oh.
And there's
so it did come back. I was surprised, but it's all leafed out now and pretty.
Just monitor it this year, and if you start to see the same damage, take a look to see if it is the rose chafer or the rose bush beetle.
All right. Well, thank you so much.
You're very welcome. Thank you for calling, Rose.
You are listening to What's Bugging You from Red River Radio with our resident entomologist, Dr. Beverly Burton, and we have three calls online. Rudy and Greg from Longview, you're on deck, but we're going to go to another Greg right now. Greg, you're online with Dr. Beverly Burton. What's bugging you?
Yes, I was calling to ask about two insects. One's a caterpillar, which makes a moth, I reckon. Catawba worms. I remember years ago that every catawba tree was loaded down with worms we use for fish bait. I haven't seen none of them in years. And walking sticks, the long walking sticks, I used to see them, and I hadn't seen them for years. I was just wondering if the pesticides has caused them to disappear, or if it was something else?
That's a great question, and you're actually asking about two of my favorite insects, so I'm going to have fun with this. The catawba worms are pretty much host-specific to the catawba tree, and you're right, they absolutely make fantastic fish bait, and catawba seeds are not that hard to germinate. I've done some research into that, and thinking perhaps when I retire, I may just have a catawba forest and collect catawba worms and be the fishing bait queen of the Arklatex. I think you hit the nail right on the head. It's called urban sprawl. And as we spread urbanly and as we're using more and more pesticides, we are seeing a decline in some of our insects that we kind of have a childhood affinity for. Now, walking sticks, it may be something completely different. The unique thing about walking sticks, and for our listening audience, these are these long things. They have very long legs, and they look like a stick. They're completely harmless, except they can bite, but they can't break the skin. I found that out with the testing. One bit me one time, and I was completely taken off guard. But walking sticks are forest insects, but they do come into urban areas from time to time. But what's interesting is that it takes their eggs 2 years to hatch. And so we'll see 1 year the populations will increase, and then the next year not so much, and then the next year the populations will be noticeable, and then the next year not so much, because of this oscillating 2 year cycle of the eggs to hatch. Now every year you should be able to find walking sticks out there, but some years may be a little bit more than less. And along the same vein, I get the same question asked a lot about lightning bugs. And I've seen an increase in lightning bugs for the last 3 years. And so I'm thinking that they may be coming back into the urban environment. And what kid of our age didn't collect lightning bugs and put them in a jar?
Yeah, exactly.
It was our favorite. And poke holes in it and put grass in there, and that's their favorite thing.
There you go.
Thanks for the questions, Greg.
Yes, ma'am. Thank you.
You are listening to What's Bugging You with our resident entomologist, Dr. Beverly Burden, and she is here to answer your questions about our insect world, both the fiendish kind and the friendly kind. We're going to go now to Greg from Longview. Greg, you're online with Dr. Beverly Burden. What's bugging you tonight?
Well, Dr. Burden.
Yes, Greg.
Appreciate you doing this program.
My pleasure.
I've got a couple more bee questions. I've got two types of bees on my property that I'm not 100% sure. Someone told me I've got one that's a very aggressive bee. Anytime I get near there, have a hive in the ground. They don't look like what I've typically expected yellow jackets to look like with a thin body. They're really a fat body bee, but they're very, very aggressive. If we get within 20 feet of that hole in the ground, then they're coming after us, and they'll chase us. And I'm not, they have three yellow bands and four black bands. I don't know if that helps at all.
Well, there are two different types of bees that have the potential of being ground nest. And one is called the yellow face bee, and they can be very, very aggressive. Now, let me ask you about their size. Would it be closer to the size of a honeybee or closer to the size of a bumblebee?
They're closer to the size of a honeybee.
Yeah, then that sounds like it could actually be honeybees. And whereas they may appear to be nesting in the ground, most of the time there may be some kind of an additional structure in that area that may be harboring the honeybees. If it's honeybees, please leave them alone. One thing that you can tell by honeybees is if you look at them, if you happen to catch a couple dead ones, look at their hind legs, and there'll be a very flat area on their hind legs in which they pack pollen. And it's called the corbicula. Whereas yellow-faced bees, not so much as pollen packers. And so it's pretty easy to tell them apart. And I'm sure they're bees because, like we just talked about, bees have a very broad waist attachment of the abdomen, whereas the wasps are very narrow. Did you have a second question about bees, Greg?
I did. I also have a very large bee. Looks like a bumblebee. They're not aggressive. We've got carpenter bees and bumblebees on the property. But these bees are—they're the biggest bees I've ever seen, really, and they have white faces. Their faces are white.
What color is their behind? Do you know?
One thick yellow band and black. The base is mostly black. They have one big thick yellow band on their behind.
What do you think? Why do you think they're not bumblebees?
I've never seen bumblebees with white faces before.
Yeah, there is. A metallic bee that kind of has a round face, but it could be the yellow-faced bee, but I have a feeling this probably is a bumblebee. Maybe you just haven't noticed the white face before, but if you want to catch some and send them to me, Beverly Burden at LSUS Report, I'll be glad to look at them for you.
All right. And you might be right about them being honeybees on the first set of bees. They're under a pear tree. The hole goes underneath a pretty large pear tree root system.
Yeah, that sounds very indicative to honeybees to me.
Okay, I'll definitely leave them alone.
Well, you know, honeybees are what's fascinating is honeybees are not native to the United States. A lot of people don't realize that. Mm. The Europeans that settled Jamestown actually brought the honeybees with them, and they have been outpopulating some of our native bees, well, since the establishment of Jamestown. But the honeybees have been in decline over the last several years, but the USDA now says that they may be rebounding. It was something that's called the colony collapse disorder, and it was a combination of a virus and a mite infection, that's MITE, like little baby ticks. And but the USDA thinks that they're now on the rebound, and that's great news. And I just saw a news story this week. I don't know if you saw it, where a semi-truck overturned, and there was like bees all over the highway. I think it was either Arizona or California. Really? And there is big business in shipping beehives into areas that need more pollination, and people are paying for pollination. It's amazing. Thanks for your call, Greg.
Thank you, ma'am. Have a good day.
You are listening to What's Bugging You with our resident entomologist, Dr. Beverly Burden, and you can call in right now at 800-552-8502. We have lines open right now. That's 800-552-8502 with any question about our insect world, both the fiendish insects and the friendly insects. And we're going to go to Rudy next from Shreveport. Rudy, you're online with Dr. Burden. What's bugging you tonight?
Thank you. Not really anything bugging me. I just was curious. Moved to the Shreveport area a little over a year ago. And last year about this time, we had a horrible infestation in the home with this little, I don't know, I guess you call them like a midge fly. And an old-timer told my wife to hang a Ziploc baggie full of water over the door. And I'm trying to figure out how come that works.
I don't think it does. I've heard that with mosquitoes. I've heard it with house flies. I've heard it with almost any type of flies. This time of the year, as things start warming up and things start to become active, if you have a large infestation of any kind of gnat or midge in your house, the first thing you have to look at is some type of a moist organic environment. And most of the time, that's going to be in the form of a potted plant. And because the immatures of flies, nobody likes to use this word, but they're called maggots, they must have a moist organic environment to live in. And what I tell people is to let your house plants dry out a little bit more drier before you rehydrate them. And also, a lot of times, what's popular in the households today are those little bamboo plants that are actually sitting in water. Those can get infested with the flies, too. Did you have another comment, Rudy?
No, that's it. I was just curious because it seems sort of ridiculous to me, and I just wanted to know if it would actually work or not.
Yeah, the Ziploc bag thing, the theory is that because flies have these faceted eyes, the little, what we call the omatidia, that the reflections of the water onto their eyes scares them and they fly away. And and maybe they think it's giant dragonflies coming to eat them or something because, you know, dragonflies are very iridescent in their own right. But it's an old tale that has never been proven affirmative that it works. It's been more like incidental things. Maybe people are just more aware of them.
All right. I appreciate that. Thank you.
Thanks for the call, Rudy.
Thanks for calling. You are listening to What's Bugging You with our resident entomologist, Dr. Beverly Burden. And you can give us a call tonight at 800-552-8502 with any question about our insect world, both fiendish and friendly. That's 800-552-8502. We have lines open right now. Give us a call. And Kevin from Zavala, Texas, you're online next. What's bugging you?
Well, I'm an avid gardener, and I'm trying to create my garden to be a way station for monarchs. And, you know, I've planted a lot of flowers. And, you know, in our part of Texas, the butterfly weed is barely starting to bloom now. But I have a question. This is as a gardener and someone who wants to do everything I can do to preserve the monarchs. Why does milkweed become infested with little aphids? And what, you know, it's hard. If it were any other plant, I would not plant any more of it. Mm-hmm. I think it's beautiful, and I love it. I mean, when it's clean, but I just hate walking by and seeing it infested with, I guess they're aphids or something. I don't know.
Well, let's first explain, Kevin, what aphids are. Aphids are easily seen with the naked eye, but they're relatively small insects. If you take a look at a grain of uncooked rice, they may be about approximately that third of a size. And there are many insects that are like mosquitoes, but they feed on plant sap. And that's what aphids do. They're actually sucking into the plant. And milkweeds are the same as any other plant. They have vascular tissue where they're bringing in water, they're bringing in sap from the roots to feed the leaves, and the aphids basically tap in there, and they're feeding on the nectar just like you would tap a maple tree to get the syrup out of it. Now, if you want to do something not to harm the monarchs and not to deter so much, there is something that we call an insecticidal soap.
Yes, that, I've used those before.
That you can spray, and it works against these soft-bodied insects, like aphids, but I would be very careful not to spray it on the monarch caterpillars. The monarch caterpillars.
Well, I heard that you can just put like 2 drops of dishwashing detergent with a half a gallon of water and do that and spray it. I mean, is it okay?
That's the same thing. It's soap. It's soap water.
Right. Yeah,
you don't have to go buy insecticidal soap water. Put a couple drops of dishwashing liquid and spray it. You just don't want it to be too concentrated because it can be what we call phytopathic, and it can harm the milkweeds at that time. Mm-hmm. And something else, Kevin, the problem that we're having with the decline of the monarch butterfly is that its overwintering habitat in Mexico and Central America is being eroded away.
Right.
And we can do whatever we want in the United States, but with their destruction of overwintering habitat, everything that we do is going to be nullified, and that's a shame.
But an interesting thought is that, an evolutionary process might drive them to seek other wintering ground, which could be here, Anyway, I don't know. I hope they don't die out. love them. They're so beautiful.
They are, yeah. And good for you for promoting the habitat for their immature as they migrate through the United States. Thank you for your call, Kevin.
You're welcome, Bob.
You are listening to What's Bugging You with our resident entomologist, Dr. Beverly Burden, and you can give us a call tonight at 800-552-8502. Any question about our insect world, both fiendish and friendly, is welcome. Again, that number is 800-552-8502. And we have Danielle from Gilmer, Texas, and you are online next. Danielle, what's your question tonight?
Hello?
Yes, you're online with Dr. Beverly Burden.
Hello, Doctor. I had a question about, and the name of Daniel, I'm sorry, about wasps.
Mm-hmm.
And what I could do to prevent, I'm living in a trailer home, and
right. We
put underskirting that some parts don't have.
Yeah.
How to try to discourage them from being around.
You can do a couple things. One is routine inspection. Get the nest if you're talking about wasps, I assume that you're talking about the yellow jackets, the paper wasp. The paper wasp build paper. The yellow jackets sometimes may go into a ground. But if you see wasps coming and going from an area, inspect that area. And go ahead and knock down the nest, if it's a paper wasp, before it gets very big, before it gets to be a problem, and you have to go out and buy that wasp spray that shoots 27 feet, which is kind of cool.
Right.
Inspection. The second,
I have red wasps.
The second thing, you'll see them coming and going. The other thing you can do is find some yellow dishes, go to the dollar store or something, and buy some low-lying yellow dishes, kind of like a Frisbee dish, and put soapy water on it, or in it,
okay. And
they're attracted to yellow, and they're that's a trick of the trade on how to capture wasps. Soapy water in a yellow dish, and I'd put one on every in on the front of my trailer house, the back, both sides, and monitor those. If you see a lot of wasps coming in and dying in that soapy water in the yellow dish, then you might know that you got a problem.
Oh, so then I can continue to keep doing that and they'll die.
Yeah, continue. No problem. That way you're monitoring, you're actually baiting them in, and you're using a scientific method to monitor the populations. If the populations get so high, find out where they're nesting at, boom, you got them.
Awesome. You've been a very big help.
Good luck with that, Daniel.
I did have one other question.
Okay.
Bed bugs and how to discourage them from coming in.
Bed bugs do not fly. They do not walk very far. The way they get into your house is if you bring them into your house.
Right.
And the classic method is to go visit somebody who has bed bugs, and normally we store our suitcases on the floor, under the bed, And so, and they climb in your suitcase, you bring them home. If you happen to have a bed bug infestation at home, the first thing to do is to make sure that you have a correct identification. Bed bugs are about the same size, shape, and coloration of a small apple seed. And oftentimes you'll have blood flakes on the bed. They like to hide in tight places behind wallpaper, down into the bed boards. Inspection, inspection, inspection. If you inspect and you have bed bugs, then we've got a problem. There is a new chemical that's being evaluated at this time that they claim to be a safe house chemical to do, but normally you have to do some other types of extermination.
The 91% isopropyl alcohol kills them on contact.
I would think that would be a good method, but for every bed bug that you see, there's going to probably be five more that you don't see, just like cockroaches. Inspection and kill.
Okay. Yeah, we inspected and we killed a bunch of them, and it just seemed like they kind of died down now, but I might like see one every once in a while, and I don't want them to populate.
That's right. For thorough inspection. And you know, the one thing about bed bugs, unlike mosquitoes, is they're not known to transmit any diseases. They're nuisance. Fleas can transmit diseases. Lice can transmit diseases. Mosquitoes can transmit diseases. But until now, knock on the wood that they're hiding behind, they can't.
Okay.
Okay, well, that helped out very much. Thank you very much, Doctor.
Good luck with that, Daniel.
Thank you for the call, and you are listening to What's Bugging You with our resident entomologist, Dr. Beverly Burden. We go to William next from Lufkin. William, you're online with Dr. Burden. What's bugging you tonight?
Hello. I had a question. I was curious about what they call mosquito hawks and it's exactly what kind of bug that is.
That's a great question, William. Mosquito hawk is neither a mosquito nor a hawk. And the common wives' tale kind of a thing is that they're called mosquito hawks because they feed on mosquitoes. They do not. And I think the reason that got started is because they look like a big mosquito. You know, if you look like a big mosquito, so I don't know, maybe you eat mosquitoes. But they don't. The adults actually don't feed. The immatures, like the immature of most flies, basically develop in the ground, in the gardens, just like I said before, in moist soil, most humid, organic-rich material. And they're completely harmless. They are a nuisance when they get in your house and they fly around and then they die in the corner. But also, I've trained my dog to catch and kill them, and it's entertainment value for Wally and I. We'd like to see her go after them. And cats okay. like to hunt them, too.
Okay, so what exactly are they?
They are a fly.
They are flies.
Yeah,
okay.
They're in the family Tapulidae, and sometimes we call them crane flies.
Okay.
But there's other things that we call crane flies, too. That's the problem with common names.
Yeah.
Right. Okay, well, that's all I have today.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, thank you for your call, William. And you are listening to What's Bugging You with our resident entomologist, Dr. Beverly Burden. We're going to go next to Earl from Palestine, Texas. Earl, you're online with Dr. Burden. What's bugging you? Hello, Earl.
Well, hello?
Yes. Is this Earl or Opal?
Sounds like Earl.
Earl.
Hey.
Okay, Earl, you're breaking up. We're going to have to move on to the next call. Call back, okay. And maybe we'll get a better line. So we're going to go next to Opal from Shreveport. Opal, you're online with Dr. Burden. What's bugging you?
Hi, Dr. Burden. Thank you so much for taking my call. I was calling about wasps that are drinking or attacking my hummingbird feeder. And I don't want to run my hummingbirds away, but I want to get rid of the wasps because my hummingbirds won't come. They'll just hover in the air. Hello?
Yes, I have...
I'm sorry. They'll just hover in the air, and the wasps will actually chase them away.
Well, I've seen the hummingbirds chase the wasp away, too. This is my feeling on this, Opal. First of all, I put the nectar out there, the hummingbird food, for the hummingbirds. And I can't not invite the other wild critters to the party.
Okay.
And so I would rather have a little bit of nuisance of hunting of a wasp sharing the nectar than not feeding the hummingbirds at all. Does that make sense?
Yes, it does. But, you know, the thing of it is, you know, they really can't get the nectar, you know, because the little tiny hole is so small. I mean, but they are stand guard and try anyway.
A lot of times there's just enough little droplets there that they are actually getting some type of things. Now, the one thing that I absolutely won't tolerate was a couple years ago, I had a squirrel that would hang upside down by its feet and drink the nectar out of the bird like it was a baby's bottle. And I was always running and chasing him off. But that was, but I would just share with the wasp.
Okay.
And still feed the hummingbirds.
Okay. Okay. One other quick question.
Yes, ma'am.
Grits. Do they really work for the ant mound?
No, ma'am, they don't. Neither grits nor cornmeal. And whereas the thought behind it would seem like it would work, it just doesn't.
Okay. Before I go throw my grits out.
No, don't put your grits out.
Okay.
Put them in the pot.
You got to eat those grits.
Okay. Thank you so much.
You are listening to What's Bugging You with Dr. Beverly Burton, our resident entomologist. And we're going to close out. We had one online question. We've been saving it. And this caller from Boyce wanted to know what non-chemical pesticide could be used for leaf-cutting ants that are causing a problem at their place. So something that is not, a harsh kind of environmental chemical that they're looking for.
Leaf-cutting ants are tough because they're very persistent. And I've never been in an area except for this part of the world where leaf-cutting ants were very well-known. Most leaf-cutting ants aren't going to establish themselves in our urban environment. But if you're living out in the country in a non-urban environment and you got a problem with leaf-cutting ants, I would find out where their nests are. And they tend to be huge. They'll cover several square yards, and you can mechanically bulldoze them out or find some other type of a mechanical barrier to basically pin them in to prevent them from getting to the leaves, but they can be very tenacious. And that's a very good question, and I'm sure there's a better answer to it today, but I don't have it. I apologize for that.
Well, I'm going to follow up with that with one of our questions, and that is, are there other natural insecticides that people can use if they don't want to go the chemical route?
Pesticides without the chemical route for ants in general?
Or any kind of insect, just a natural kind of remedy.
A lot of people like to take, they like to take hot peppers, the capsaicin, and jalapenos, and crush them up and use that as a spray. That's been very effective. And a lot of people enjoy that. Just be careful not to get it in your eyes.
So you could actually do that, like, say, around a potted plant or something like that. Would it actually hurt the plant if you sprayed a little bit of that in a liquid, like a water form, on a plant?
I would rather spray it directly on the insect, whether it be hard-bodied or soft-bodied. But test a small area and see how the plant does with it. If it's okay, then go ahead and use that Retomy. The soapy waters are really good for soft-bodied insects, and we don't consider that a naturally occurring pesticide. And then for roaches, there's boric acid that is not considered a typical pesticide.
And these will prevent the chemical problem that some people are concerned about.
Yes,
in the
absolutely.
Home.
Absolutely.
Well, Dr. Burton, I want to thank you again for a great show, and we enjoy it. And we'll be back with you in June for another edition of What's Bugging You. Bird Calls will be coming up on the third Tuesday in May with Cliff Shackelford. We hope you'll tune in for this. You've been listening to What's Bugging You with Dr. Beverly Burton. She is an associate professor of biology at LSUS and Red River Radio's resident entomologist. And we want to thank all of our callers tonight. What's Bugging You is produced by Bill Beckett with help from Wally Derleth and Henry Edwards. And Dr. Beverly Burton, thank you again for joining us tonight.
It's my pleasure, and I'll see you back in June.
This is Red River Radio, and we are your community-supported public broadcasting service from LSUS. Radio Lab is coming up next right here on Red River Radio.